Chapter 93. Blissful, all this time, I had gone on loving Dora, harder than ever. Her idea was my refuge in disappointment and distress, and made some amends to me, even for the loss of my friend. The more I pitied myself, or pitied others, the more I sought for consolation in the image of Dora. The greater the accumulation of deceit and trouble in the world, the brighter and the purer shone the star of Dora high above the world. I don't think I had any definite idea where Dora came from, or in what degree she was related to a higher order of beings, but I am quite sure I should have scouted the notion of her being simply human, like any other young lady, with indignation and contempt. If I may so express it, I was steeped in Dora. I was not merely over head and ears in love with her, but I was saturated through and through. Enough love might have been wrung out of me, metaphorically speaking, to drown anybody in, and yet there would have remained enough within me, and all over me, to pervade my entire existence. The first thing I did, on my own account, when I came back, was to take a night walk to Norwood, and, like the subject of a venerable riddle of my childhood, to go round and round the house, without ever touching the house, thinking about Dora. I believe the theme of this incomprehensible conundrum was the moon. No matter what it was, I, the moonstruck slave of Dora, perambulated round and round the house and garden for 2 hours, looking through crevices in the palings, getting my chin by dint of violent exertion above the rusty nails on the top, blowing kisses at the lights in the windows, and romantically calling on the night, at intervals, to shield my door I don't exactly know what from, I suppose from fire, perhaps from mice, to which she had a great objection. My love was so much in my mind, and it was so natural to me to confide in Peggotty, when I found her again by my side of an evening with the old set of industrial implements, busily making the tour of my wardrobe, that I imparted to her, in a sufficiently roundabout way, my great secret. Peggotty was strongly interested, but I could not get her into my view of the case at all. She was audaciously prejudiced in my favor, and quite unable to understand why I should have any misgivings, or be low-spirited about it. The young lady might think herself well off, apostrophe she observed, to have such a beau. And as to her pa, apostrophe she said, what did the gentleman expect, for gracious sake? Apostrophe, I observed, however, that Mr. Spenlow's pictorial gown and stiff cravat took Peggotty down a little, and inspired her with a greater reverence for the man who was gradually becoming more and more etherealized in my eyes every day, and about whom a reflected radiance seemed to me to beam when he sat erect in court among his papers, like a little lighthouse in a sea of stationery. And by the by, it used to be uncommonly strange to me to consider, I remember, as I sat in court too, how those dim old judges and doctors wouldn't have cared for Dora, if they had known her, how they wouldn't have gone out of their senses with rapture, if marriage with Dora had been proposed to them, how Dora might have sung, and played upon that glorified guitar, until she led me to the verge of madness, yet not have tempted one of those slow-goers an inch out of his road. I despised them, to a man. Frozen-out old gardeners, in the flower-beds of the heart, I took a personal offense against them all. The bench was nothing to me, but an insensible blunderer. The bar had no more tenderness or poetry in it than the bar of a public house. Taking the management of Peggotty's affairs into my own hands, with no little pride, I proved the will, and came to a settlement with the Legacy Duty Office, and took her to the bank, and soon got everything into an orderly train. We varied the legal character of these proceedings by going to see some perspiring waxwork in Fleet Street melted, I should hope, these 20 years, and by visiting Miss Linwood's exhibition, which I remember as a mausoleum of needlework, favorable to self-examination and repentance, and by inspecting the Tower of London, and going to the top of St. Paul's. All these wonders afforded Peggotty as much pleasure as she was able to enjoy, under existing circumstances. Except, I think, St. Paul's, which, from her long attachment to her workbox, became a rival of the picture on the lid, and was, in some particulars, vanquished, she considered, by that work of art. Peggotty's business, which was what we used to call common form businesses in the commons, and very light and lucrative the common form business was, being settled, I took her down to the office one morning to pay her bill. Mr. Spenlow had stepped out, old Tiffy said, to get a gentleman sworn for a marriage license. But as I knew he would be back directly, our place lying close to the surrogates, and to the Vicar General's office too, I told Peggotty to wait. We were a little like undertakers, in the commons, as regarded probate transactions, generally making it a rule, to look more or less cut up, when we had to deal with clients in mourning. In a similar feeling of delicacy, we were always blithe, and light-hearted with the licensed clients. Therefore I hinted to Peggotty that she would find Mr. Spenlow much recovered from the shock of Mr. Barkis's decease, and indeed he came in like a bridegroom. But neither Peggotty nor I had eyes for him when we saw, in company with him, Mr. Murdstone. He was very little changed. His hair looked as thick, and was certainly as black, as ever, and his glance was as little to be trusted as of old. Ah, Copperfield? ' said Mr. Spenlow. You know this gentleman, I believe? ' I made my gentleman a distant bow, and Peggotty barely recognized him. He was, at first, somewhat disconcerted to meet us two together, but quickly decided what to do, and came up to me. I hope, ' he said, that you are doing well? ' It can hardly be interesting to you, said one. Yes, if you wish to know. We looked at each other, and he addressed himself to Peggotty. And you, said he. I am sorry to observe that you have lost your husband. It's not the first loss I have had in my life, Mr. Murdstone, replied Peggotty, trembling from head to foot. I am glad to hope that there is nobody to blame for this one, nobody to answer for it. Said he, that's a comfortable reflection. You have done your duty? I have not worn anybody's life away, said Peggotty, I am thankful to think. No, Mr. Murdstone, I have not worried and frightened any sweet creature to an early grave. He either gloomily or remorsefully I thought for an instant, and said, turning his head towards me, but looking at my feet instead of my face. We are not likely to encounter soon again, a source of satisfaction to us both, no doubt, for such meetings as this can never be agreeable. I do not expect that you, who always rebelled against my just authority, exerted for your benefit and reformation, should owe me any goodwill now. There is an antipathy between us, an old one, I believe? Said I, interrupting him. He smiled, and shot as evil a glance at me as could come from his dark eyes. It rankled in your baby breast, he said. It embittered the life of your poor mother. You are right. I hope you may do better, yet, I hope you may correct yourself. Here he ended the dialogue, which had been carried on in a low voice, in a corner of the outer office, by passing into Mr. Spenlow's room, and saying aloud, in his smoothest manner, gentlemen of Mr. Spenlow's profession are accustomed to family differences, and know how complicated and difficult they always are. With that, he paid the money for his license, and, receiving it neatly folded from Mr. Spenlow, together with a shake of the hand, and a polite wish for his happiness and the ladies, went out of the office. I might have had more difficulty in constraining myself to be silent under his words, if I had had less difficulty in impressing upon Peggotty, who was only angry on my account, good creature, that we were not in a place for recrimination, and that I besought her to hold her peace. She was so unusually aroused that I was glad to compound for an affectionate hug, elicited by this revival in her mind of our old injuries, and to make the best I could of it, before Mr. Spenlow and the clerks. Mr. Spenlow did not appear to know what the connection between Mr. Murdstone and myself was, which I was glad of, for I could not bear to acknowledge him, even in my own breast, remembering what I did of the history of my poor mother. Mr. Spenlow seemed to think, if he thought anything about the matter, that my aunt was the leader of the state party in our family, and that there was a rebel party commanded by somebody else, so I gathered at least from what he said, while we were waiting for Mr. Tiffy, to make out Peggotty's bill of costs. Miss Trotwood, apostrophe he remarked, is very firm, no doubt, and not likely to give way to opposition. I have an admiration for her character, and I may congratulate you, Copperfield, on being on the right side. Differences between relations are much to be deplored, but they are extremely general, and the great thing is, to be on the right side. Meaning, I take it, on the side of the moneyed interest. Rather a good marriage this, I believe? Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Spenlow. I explained that I knew nothing about it. Indeed. Apostrophe apostrophe he said. Speaking from the few words Mr. Murdstone dropped as a man frequently does on these occasions, and from what Miss Murdstone let fall, I should say it was rather a good marriage. Apostrophe, do you mean, that there is money, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. Yes, apostrophe, said Mr. Spenlow, I understand there's money. Beauty too, I am told. Apostrophe, indeed. Is his new wife young? Apostrophe, just of age, apostrophe, said Mr. Spenlow. So lately, that I should think they had been waiting for that. Apostrophe, Lord deliver her. Apostrophe apostrophe said Peggotty. So very emphatically and unexpectedly, that we were all three discomposed, until Tiffy came in with the bill. Old Tiffy soon appeared, however, and handed it to Mr. Spenlow, to look over. Mr. Spenlow, settling his chin in his cravat and rubbing it softly, went over the items with a deprecatory air, as if it were all Jorkin's doing, and handed it back to Tiffy with a bland sigh. Yes, apostrophe he said. That's right. Quite right. I should have been extremely happy, Copperfield, to have limited these charges to the actual expenditure out of pocket, but it is an irksome incident in my professional life that I am not at liberty to consult my own wishes. I have a partner, Mr. Jorkins. Apostrophe, as he said this with a gentle melancholy, which was the next thing to making, no charge at all, I expressed my acknowledgments on Peggotty's behalf, and paid Tiffy in banknotes. Peggotty then retired to her lodging, and Mr. Spenlow and I went into court, where we had a divorce suit coming on, under an ingenious little statute repealed now, I believe, but in virtue of which I have seen several marriages annulled, of which the merits were these. The husband, whose name was Thomas Benjamin, had taken out his marriage license as Thomas only, suppressing the Benjamin, in case he should not find himself as comfortable as he expected. Not finding himself as comfortable as he expected, or being a little fatigued with his wife, poor fellow, he now came forward, by a friend, after being married a year or two, and declared that his name was Thomas Benjamin, and therefore he was not married at all, which the court confirmed, to his great satisfaction. I must say, that I had my doubts about the strict justice of this, and was not even frightened out of them by the bushel of wheat which reconciles all anomalies. But Mr. Spenlow argued the matter with me. He said, look at the world, there was good, and evil in that. Look at the ecclesiastical law, there was good, and evil in that. It was all part of a system. Very good. There you were. I had not the hardihood to suggest to Dora's father that possibly we might even improve the world a little if we got up early in the morning and took off our coats to the work, but I confessed that I thought we might improve the commons. Mr. Spenlow replied that he would particularly advise me to dismiss that idea from my mind, as not being worthy of my gentlemanly character, but that he would be glad to hear from me of what improvement I thought the commons susceptible. Taking that part of the commons which happened to be nearest to us, for our man was unmarried by this time, and we were out of court, and strolling past the prerogative office, I submitted that I thought the prerogative office rather a queerly managed institution. Mr. Spenlow inquired in what respect? I replied, with all due deference to his experience, but with more deference, I am afraid, to his being Dora's father, that perhaps it was a little nonsensical that the registry of that court, containing the original wills of all persons leaving effects within the immense province of Canterbury, for three whole centuries, should be an accidental building, never designed for the purpose, leased by the registrars for their own private emolument, unsafe, not even ascertained to be fireproof, choked with the important documents it held, and positively, from the roof to the basement. A mercenary speculation of the registrars, who took great fees from the public, and crammed the public's wills away anyhow and anywhere, having no other object than to get rid of them cheaply. That, perhaps, it was a little unreasonable that these registrars, in the receipt of profits amounting to £8,000 or £9,000 a year, to say nothing of the profits of the deputy registrars and clerks of seats, should not be obliged to spend a little of that money in finding a reasonably safe place for the important documents which all classes of people were compelled to hand over to them, whether they would or no. That, perhaps, it was a little unjust that all the great offices in this great office should be magnificent sinecures, while the unfortunate working clerks in the cold dark room upstairs were the worst rewarded, and the least considered men, doing important services, in London. That perhaps it was a little indecent that the principal registrar of all, whose duty it was to find the public, constantly resorting to this place, all needful accommodation, should be an enormous sinecurist in virtue of that post, and might be, besides, a clergyman, a pluralist, the holder of a staff in a cathedral, and what not, while the public was put to the inconvenience, of which we had a specimen every afternoon, when the office was busy, and which we knew to be quite monstrous. That, perhaps, in short, this prerogative office of the Diocese of Canterbury was altogether such a pestilent job, and such a pernicious absurdity, that but for its being squeezed away in a corner of St. Paul's Churchyard, which few people knew, it must have been turned completely inside out, and upside down, long ago. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.